Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Tristan Riddell.
And I'm Matt Hansen.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
This is episode 25 of the Nerd Party. Thank you so much for downloading. Thank you so much for listening. And we are very excited to bring you this week's episode. We are going to be talking about our top five favorite Pixar films. We love doing our top five favorite of anything, whether it's TV shows, films, a specific type of genre, a specific type of director, or directors themselves. And Pixar is just fun. It's just wholesome. It's just wholesome and wholehearted fun. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree, and we also like doing things that are tied into current nerd or movie or TV or whatever events, and we're doing this, of course, in anticipation of the release of the new Pixar film Inside Out this Friday, June 19th.
I'm pretty excited about that one. I'm not stoked, you know, I'm not gripping my seat going, I can't wait, but I am excited to see Amy Poehler do some more voice work. Because I'm a huge Amy Poehler fan.
You know, not that it counts for anything if you put stock into it or not, but it's gotten great early reviews, like fantastic early reviews. I think with 29 reviews so far, it's still at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, hey, that's really good. I didn't know that. That's good to hear, because there's been... Pixar has had some...
It's had its ups and downs, like any studio would.
Yeah.
As old as it is. And, you know, it's this year's 2015. It's been 20 years since Toy Story 1.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing is that Pixar has never had one that's just been like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe that piece of crap. I mean, like,
well,
granted,
some would argue with the Cars franchise,
right? I was just about to say, like, once you take Cars and Cars 2 out of the equation, but I mean, like, ever since, like, you had Toy Story 3 in 2010, and then, but that's the thing is that in 2011 you had Cars 2, 2012 you had Brave, and in 2013 you had Monsters University. Those movies were just okay. You know, like Brave, like a lot of people like Brave, but it was just okay. And Monsters University was just okay. You know,
well, you should be happy to know then that from what the reviews that I have read, everyone is calling Inside Out a return to Pixar for like in Toy Story 3 level quality.
That's great. That's really great to hear. And that excites me. And I'm quite happy about that, and because I'm a big Pixar fan, and I'm not a huge critic of them. I'm just kind of like, okay, all right, that movie happened, or that was amazing. Ever since, I mean, like you said, it's like Toy Story came out in 1995, so that's 20 years. That's insane.
Yeah, not every studio can have a batting average of 1,000. You're not going to have A+ films all the time.
You're absolutely right. I think that's the thing, is that Pixar is held to a very high standard. And I think they're held to a higher standard than any other production company that I can think of, even more so than Marvel.
Yeah, but it's kind of the same thing with Marvel. I mean, Pixar more so, but Marvel, like Pixar, had like a hot streak. And is, you know, some would argue is continuing to have a hot streak, so that the pressure's on.
Yeah.
Maybe, and sometimes I would argue unfairly, but, you know.
No, I'm with you on that one. I think you're right. I think it's a little unfair, because once you start batting 100s and 99s and 95s and even 92s just constantly, and then all of a sudden you have a 73, people are like, "Oh, has Pixar lost their magic?"
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's just it's BS.
Because we're so ready to jump on and point out failure as a society.
As a society, we've talked about this so many times. It's very much Schadenfreude, where we delight in other people's failure, and I don't know why, but you and I are very forgiving nerds, and that's why we started the show together. But before we get into our top five, we have a few things to talk about.
Let's talk about something that this weekend definitely wasn't a failure.
Now, this weekend, you saw a new release of a speaking of franchises, you saw a new release of a big outing of a very popular franchise, and that is Jurassic World.
Yeah, our last podcast, as a matter of fact, was going through our retrospective of the Jurassic Park franchise up until this point. Jurassic World wasn't out yet, but at least I was very much looking forward to seeing it. I didn't go to the midnight show like I normally do. I mean, if I go to the midnight show these days on Thursday nights, it means I have to take Friday off.
That you reached that age, huh?
I mean, I get up at work at 5:30. So if I'm going to midnight and getting out at 2, that means sleeping for 3 hours and going to work. So I only do that with very, very anticipated releases. For me, it's usually Marvel movies. But I was there opening day on Friday for Jurassic World, hoping that, knowing that it wasn't going to be the first one. Let's just get that out of the way for anybody who has these unrealistic expectations that it's going to capture the magic and tone of the first one. Mm-hmm. It can't. By virtue of being a sequel, it can't. And a lot of the more negative reviews I saw on Rotten Tomatoes were criticizing for that, and I think that's, of all the criticism that you could lobby at this movie, I think that's the most undeserving. Yes, it's in the same franchise, but it can't be the first one. So stop trying to make it the first one. That being said, my only hope was that, even though I wasn't bothered by The Lost World as much as you were, my hope was that it just has to be better than the last two. That's all I wanted. I wanted a fun sequel, if not a great one. And thankfully, I'm happy to report that my ranking of the Jurassic Park films, having seen the new one, is now 1-4-2-3.
Now, that's, like, you said that last week, or last episode. That
was
that's
my
all
hope.
That was your hope. That's all that you wanted. That you wanted to change your ranking to 1-4-3-2. Or, excuse me, 1-4-2-3. And I'm very happy for you. I'm glad that you enjoyed it that much. Because what I'm getting some very mixed reviews on Twitter and on Tumblr and everything like that. People kind of going back and forth, back and forth. And so this is going to be a spoiler-free review of Jurassic World. What were some of the things that you liked the most about it?
Well, let me say, for the first thing, one of the things that it does capture from the first one is the cinematography is gorgeous. Oh. The park and the island look incredible. And I actually think this is one of the few movies where 3D enhances the experience. It was so colorful and so vibrant. The criticisms that you've probably read probably have to do with the characters and some of the characterizations. And I will say, you know, to cut them some slack, they aren't terribly interesting characters. They're the characters that the story needs. I mean, okay. they're very surface level, very superficial, and I think that for people in this day and age who expect deep character development, or, you know, avant-garde storytelling, you're not going to get that here. I mean, the characters serve a very rudimentary purpose. Whether or not you go with them or not, I think depends on if you like the actors. And I think that for a lot of people, including myself, Chris Pratt has enough goodwill where even if his character doesn't have a lot of deep emotional development, you still go with him because he's a charismatic lead and a charismatic actor. Mm-hmm. I liked Bryce Dallas Howard. I always kind of liked Bryce Dallas Howard. I do think they fall with her character into the working woman cliche a bit. But again, this is a movie that... for me, kind of harkens back to the kind of storytelling that was present in 1993 with the original, if not capturing the exact same feel. Because some of the criticisms that I feel that are lobbied at the characters in Jurassic World could easily be applied, I think, to the characters in Jurassic Park, the original. We liked Alan Grant and Ian Malcolm, but did they really have deep emotional character development? I mean, they had some, but... The level that people are desiring these days weren't present back then either. I think that the film has just been elevated to a very high status that we ascribe those things because we look back on that movie so fondly, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, some of the criticisms that people are leveling at Bryce Dallas Howard could easily have been applied to Laura Dern.
Yeah,
you know. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing where it's like, that doesn't bother me. The criticism about the kids kind of being in the way and maybe a little bit more annoying doesn't bother me because they serve the same purpose that Tim and Lex did in the first one. Maybe a little less developed than Tim and Lex, but the same purpose. So, you know, a lot of that doesn't bother me. The CGI, which people were complaining about a lot, I thought looked fine. Mm-hmm. I thought it looked they obviously cleaned it up from that first trailer, like I said that they would. Mm-hmm. It looks pretty cool. The climax alone, though, I will say, is worth the price of admission.
Hey, that's good.
I'm not going to spoil what it is, but I think that The climax was a lot of fun. It got me and my friends really excited. And I will say that the callbacks that they do to the first one, some of them might feel ham-fisted to some more cynical people, but I was eating them up. I thought it was so fun. There's a specific scene in this movie where they come across something from the first one. I won't say what it is, but like I was really, really happy and shocked and very, very pleased that this director was so respectful to the first one without aping everything from it.
That's good. The climax got ruined for me because some jackass online just started complaining about it and did not care that that person was ruining it for everybody else without, like, no tags, no nothing, no warning, just bam.
See, I hate things like that. If you don't like this movie, fine, but that doesn't mean you have to ruin it for everybody else. I mean, and that's the thing that I can't stand seeing this weekend is, if you don't like the movie, fine, but, you know, going on and complaining about it and just harping on why it's such a terrible movie, how it's, you know, anti this and anti that and not the first one and dumb or whatever, you know what, fine,
but yeah,
whatever, but don't drag those of us who enjoyed it down with you. And clearly we're not the only ones, because this thing was expected to do maybe 125 or 130 million this weekend. It did $202 million. It beat Avengers Age of Ultron. It has a chance of even beating the opening weekend of the first Avengers.
Yeah, it's doing quite well during this opening weekend. I think it's like the third grossing weekend of all time or something
second.
Jeez.
And not only that, I think it's one of the only films to ever open globally its first weekend. It's already has $500 million made globally.
Oh, wow. Jeez. Yeah, well, congratulations to that movie, and whether you like it or not, it's a great franchise. Whether you like two or three or not, it's still a great franchise, just because they earned so much goodwill with the first one.
I can safely say, though, in the wrap up, Tristan, it's the best sequel. Don't think it's the first one. It's not going to hit the heights of the first one, but as far as the three sequels go, I'm willing to bet that this was the one that people are going to hold up and say, okay, this was decent enough where we could just do Jurassic Park and then Jurassic World.
See, that's really great, because I'm glad that you're able to do that and recognize that, because I try to do that as much as I can. Whenever there's a prequel, whenever there's a sequel, especially when there's a lot of time, you know, like in between said release, like with the Star Wars prequels, do I think the Star Wars prequels are an inferior product? Abso-friggin-lutely. I think that they are absolutely an inferior product when compared to the original Star Wars. But when you do not compare them to the original trilogy and you just watch them as an action film, as a sci-fi action film, yes, they're entertaining. I'm able to enjoy them. I watched them when I was a kid, or at least when I was younger, and I was able to enjoy them because I went in going, okay, this is not going to be A New Hope. This is not going to be Empire. This is not going to be Jedi. So let's just try to take it for what it is. And yeah, and so, like, when I see Jurassic World, I'm not going to go and expect Jurassic Park. I'm not going to go and expect Ian Malcolm or Grant or Laura Dern or whoever else is in it. I'm not going to expect to see those characters or that level of nostalgia, because we have rose-tinted glasses when it comes to Jurassic Park. And we just need to soldier on and say, like, is this movie entertaining? If it's entertaining, great. If you're not entertained, you don't need to go on a BS rant for 5 minutes because you were not entertained for a $12 movie ticket.
Yeah, I mean, the advice I'll give people is, don't go in expecting great high art. Go in expecting dino chaos and some cool action scenes.
Exactly, and that's all that you should expect. So, good. I'm glad you liked it. I saw, before we get into the Pixar section, I saw something over the weekend that I thought was quite intriguing. And it was it's kind of making the rounds on the Twitterverse and online news and everything like that. And it's a mashup, it's a re-edit, it's a fan edit of Prometheus and Alien, where it's by a man named Job Willens. It may be Job. I mean, I don't know. It's probably Job, but I haven't heard it pronounced. Job Willens.
It's okay. I'm sure he has a lot of patience.
It's by a man named Job Willens, and he's on Twitter, at Job Willens, and he does not have that many followers, so go follow him, go talk to him, and he made a fan edit called Derelict. And what he did was he combined Prometheus, both Ridley Scott films, Prometheus and Alien, and kind of the mission statement of the film was that Prometheus was a spiritual prequel to Alien, where it's set in the same universe. Like, when Ridley Scott announced it, he said it was going to be completely separate from Alien, and that it was really just set in the same universe. Well, now that we've seen it, we know that that's not true, that there are many more parallels to the Alien movies and the Alien franchise. But it didn't quite make it. Now, a lot of people, whether you like it or hate it, a lot of people didn't connect with it and didn't quite...
It didn't set the world on fire like Alien did.
Right, and this is another situation where you can't compare it to Alien, because Alien is a classic. Alien is near perfect. And if you try with any film, you're going to be disappointed. But with this, like, I was one of those people who were severely disappointed by Prometheus. Severely disappointed. I was quite angry when I watched it. But because it's Ridley Scott and because it's the Alien franchise, I gave it a couple more shots and I liked it more and more when I watched it. I still don't like it, but I liked it more and more. Like, it went from hate to mild annoyance. And
just to give my quick thoughts, I was perfectly fine with it. I didn't love it as much as I did the Alien films, but God help me, I needed something after the two AVP films and Alien 3. So,
and with this is that he kind of changed the storyline a little bit by just some opening text where you see the scene. It opens up with a scene of David going through the ship. That's the opening of the movie, not the engineers at the beginning, not them going through Scotland. It opens up with David on the ship and everybody's asleep. And then they find the planet, and then it says 30 years later. And then we're on the Nostromo and they're waking up. And so what he did was he juxtaposed the two films together, cut it down a great deal, because both films put together is still only two and a half hours. And what he did was he changed the storyline by they're investigating the same area, the same spot. It's not two different.
So did he make Prometheus happen on LV-426, or is he having Alien happen on the Prometheus planet?
It doesn't really matter. Like, it's either. Like, they don't establish where they are in either of these, in these timelines. So it's just some planet that they're investigating. One 30 years before, one, you know, present day, or whatever, however you want to look at it. And what's funny is that it makes, like, if I can judge it, it makes Alien less interesting, but it makes Prometheus more interesting. Because I really liked his Prometheus, like, what he cut out of Prometheus was the nonsense, was the stuff that did not matter. And, like, even if he just used Prometheus footage, it would only be, like, 45 minutes or an hour, but maybe probably a little bit more. But it was a solid hour of Prometheus, a solid hour and a half of Prometheus, however you want to look at it. Because it cut out all the stuff that made your eyes roll or made you go, oh God, this, why is this here? He cut out all the stuff that was just didn't need to be in there. And it was funny because he would go back and forth with his cutting between the Nostromo and between the Prometheus. And you would see parallels all the time. Like, all of a sudden, like, when the Nostromo shuttle, like, landed on the ship, and then there was a shake. Actually, no, let me cut that over. When the Prometheus landed on the planet, all of a sudden, that's when the Nostromo shuttle landed, and it all of a sudden started to shake. And so there's a few of those back and forth where the journey of Prometheus would end with the Nostromo, or when they go into a cavern and open up the door, a door would open with the Nostromo crew. And so you would find these parallels, and it was really a good journey of juxtaposition. And then all of a sudden, he did a few scenes that were cut all together and intermingled, where, like, with the climax, he cut together kind of basically the boss fights where Ripley was on the shuttle at the end trying to send the alien out the into the vacuum of space. He intercut that with Nomi Rapace's character fighting the engineer. And it just worked really well together to see those parallel journeys. And basically that's what happened, is that it was a parallel journey between these supposed 30-year separate storylines. And also he made it completely in black and white.
Oh, interesting.
And, oh, go ahead.
And he, I was going to say, this came out, what, I saw this on like on Friday, kind of emerging on the Twitter sphere.
Yeah.
My hope is that Fox hasn't taken any legal action against the man yet.
Well, there is some leeway with fan edits, because you can get away with a lot if you use the parody law.
Yeah, the fair use law.
And parody is different than fair use. Parody is different than fair use, but you can get away with a lot with the parody law, and also with academic purposes. Like if he's exploring juxtaposition with academic purposes, then he can get away with that. But I recommend
he's not profiting from this.
Yeah, though, right? He's not profiting, and it's heavily edited. So definitely go to Vimeo, check it out. It's just search Job Willens or just search Derelict. It's in the news right now. And if you're worried about it going away, download it. It's easy to download off of Vimeo, and watch it. Give it a shot. And one cool thing about the black and white, I think the reason why he did black and white is because it was a very simple way of mixing the footage better, because one was shot in the 70s, one was shot in the 2010s. And when you take the color equation out, it looks like it's much more shot of the same film.
Well, one was shot on film, and one was shot probably on digital. I don't know did Ridley Scott shoot Prometheus on film?
I honestly can't remember. Knowing Ridley, he probably did. He's a big lover of film.
That's why I asked.
But don't hold me to it. Some people thought that it enhanced the horror effect, you know, showing it in black and white. And it was very interesting seeing the Alien film in black and white. So I've been drawing on a lot about that, but it's a 2.5 hours. It's pretty good. It improves Prometheus, sometimes at the detriment of Alien, but it's you should go and watch it. It's worth watching. He also did a fan edit of the first season of Lost. He compressed 20-some hours into 3 hours and 15 minutes, and he did a really good job of that too.
Sounds like this guy's a pretty good editor. I'll be checking that out for sure.
Yeah, he's very talented, and you guys should check it out.
All right, you want to get to our top five Pixar lists?
Let's get to it. Top five. Okay, so what we normally do on the Nerd Party is we start with number five and go 5, 4, 3, 2, or we go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and we dish about it a little bit. And seeing how we've already talked for about 23 minutes, we'll probably do the next half with just Pixar. So I think I went first last time, so I think it's your turn this time.
Sure. Do you want to do it like we normally do, where if something shows up on our list, we should call out it immediately, or should we just go through our 5, 4, 3, 2?
Well, I think what we should do is, like, what we normally do is, like, if it's around the same number, you know, we should talk about it. Like, let's not give away our number ones.
Yeah. Okay.
Or even number twos. But if it's like 3 through 5, let's talk about it and say, like, oh yeah, that's my number 3, or that's my number 5, or whatever like that, because we're going to have some overlap. Because there's only 14 Pixar films right now.
That's true. And I've actually, looking at the list, I've seen less of them than I thought I did.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Even though I am a Pixar fan, the ones that I have seen, I really liked. But I haven't seen a lot of them that are on this list, or at least some of them.
Which ones haven't you seen?
Looking at the list really quick, let me bring it up. I haven't seen either of the Cars movies, but I think people say I'm better off for it.
I do love those people.
I haven't seen Monsters University. I didn't see Brave. I didn't see Ratatouille. And I've seen bits and pieces of Up, but I've never seen the full version of Up.
I'd say that's the only one that you're really missing out on is Up.
That's like, what I know. I know, and I'm aware that I'm missing out on it, but those are the ones that I have not seen.
Okay. All right, well, let's start with your number five.
Well, my number five, by consequence, it's not the last Pixar movie I saw in theaters, because we'll get to that later. But it was one that I saw when this came out. I think I was in college by this point, very early in my college career. Had heard a lot of good buzz about it, had heard good buildup about it. It's actually kind of different from a lot of their films, but I don't think it's a lesser film for it. And so my number five is WALL-E.
That is my number five as well.
And I say it's kind of different because normally you think with a Pixar film, it's usually more family, younger oriented, lots of stuff going on and that sort of thing. But what I was really taken aback by, if memory serves me right, is that a lot of the first, not the first half, but the first portion of WALL-E is not a lot of dialogue happens.
Yes.
And that was kind of weird. I mean, dare I say it, it was almost 2001-esque.
When I think of
a film that takes place mostly has a science fiction feel that doesn't have a lot of dialogue for its first portion, that's the comparison I go to. And it uses classical music in portions, or it used old Earth media.
I wouldn't say it used classical music.
And come on, there isn't 2001 homage. The computer on the ship is clearly HAL.
Yes, you are right. There is that homage there. I just was so unsatisfied by 2001 that I'm just kind of like, oh, really? But again, you are right.
Again, I mean, let's not deal with your dislike of good things.
But I like this one too. This is my number five, and I love, like, when this was being advertised, my wife and I love movies that are a lot of, how do I phrase this? We love movies that don't have a lot of dialogue. We like movies that are very visual, that are visual storytelling by people doing things and achieving things. And you are able to catch up on what's going on because of the music or because of the emotion or because of... It's kind of like the opening of There Will Be Blood. There's no dialogue. There's no speaking in like the first 15, 20 minutes. Maybe I'm exaggerating, of There Will Be Blood. And it's amazing. It's phenomenal. And this is kind of the feeling that you get. And for that alone is why it's on my list. And also because it has a really solid message as well of conservation.
It does. And what I like about it too is that it was a nice, morality tale, subtle message and not an in-your-face preachy message. And of course, I mean, the bonus added on top for me is, of course, that the computer voice on the ship is Sigourney Weaver.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Like when she first started speaking, I was just like, oh, this is amazing. I would want a computer to speak to me like Sigourney Weaver.
And of course, for me, I guess just for me, the fact that the computer looks like HAL was an added bonus as well.
Yeah, I loved I loved the color palette. I loved the griminess of the beginning and the contrast of how clean and serene everything was on the ship. And I like that we just stopped using our bodies, and so our bones just disintegrated. And it was just I could see this happening. We're seeing it happen now.
Oh yeah, this country is so lazy and so wasteful, and yeah, this is not removed from reality.
This is not a stretch. This is barely science fiction.
Right. And it was good. That was the surprising thing too, is that we're both fans of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Star Trek did a lot of, especially in the early days, a lot of these morality tales, and it was done well. It was surprising to see a kid's film do this kind of sci-fi morality tale so well. And I think that's why it earned a place on my list. So that's my number five.
Yeah, I think that's the reason why it's my number five as well. I think technically it pushed the limits. It came out in 2008, and it's I think it's number 10 on the top grossing of Pixar films. And I just, the CGI was a step above. Like this was another echelon. Yes. Reached by Pixar. I think this was the start of the new age Pixar, the new age technology that we're seeing. This had a level of detail that we had not seen before.
Which is high credit considering that Pixar kind of pioneered this kind of animation and storytelling.
Right. All right. Well, since that was both our number five, let's move on. What is your number four?
My number four is one that I'm sure shows up on a lot of people's lists. Although, it's down this far because other things have come out that I've enjoyed more, but that's not to take away the impact from this film, and that film being the original Toy Story from 1995. It had to end up on this list for me somewhere because I remember seeing this when I was a little kid and just loving it, and then getting the VHS tape and watching it over and over again. It's Pixar's first foray into making a full-length feature film. It's what put it on the map. And I don't know what can be said that hasn't been said about at least the first one in the last 20 years. It's hard to believe it's been 20 years. But this did set the world on fire. This did usher in a new age of animation and made Pixar the studio that it is now. It went from being just a CGI studio that will work on other films to start making their own media. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and the story, there's not much you can come. Everyone knows the story at this point. But it's a wonderful little kid's tale that connected with both younger kids like me and my parents who took me to see it.
It's really funny that you bring up the VHS, that you would watch the VHS over and over again, because it's funny, because would you Pixar has been around that long that they've been through 3 to 4 different changes in medium, or not medium, in media. And in 95, we had VCRs. And so I had the Toy Story VHS and watch it over and over and over again. I had the Toy Story 2 DVD, and I had the Toy Story 3 Blu-ray. And I'm sure when Toy Story 4 comes out, I may just get the digital release. You know, like it's really, really funny when you look at it that way. But we all had that VHS that we'd play over and over and over again. And I remember when Toy Story 2 came out, it was such a big deal because you could get, they had a double pack where you could get Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2 together on DVD. And people are like, well, you already have it on VHS. We're like, no, it doesn't matter. It's DVD. We're going to get the widescreen. I just remember being so excited about that.
Well, that's when we were so enamored with DVD at the turn of the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
But so obviously, I'm guessing your thoughts on the original are pretty positive as well.
Oh my gosh, yes. Like, I'll talk about it later without giving too much away. But yeah, like you said, what can be said about Toy Story that hasn't already been said? It was the pioneer, it was the original, and it was it's absolutely amazing. It paved the way for everything else. Everything will be everything will be forever compared to Toy Story. That's just how it is. And it's really funny because when you think of Pixar, you think of Toy Story. And the first Toy Story right now, and probably due to inflation, of course, but it's number 12 of the highest grossing out of 14. And it's really interesting when you look at it from that perspective.
That is cool. So that's my number 4. Lana, let's get to where you have to do some talking and revealing.
Well, it might be a little redundant, or at least a little repetitive, because my number 4 is Toy Story 3.
Okay.
I love this movie, and I battled where to put this
on the list. Yeah, the Toy Story rankings, I mean, unlike a lot of franchises where you have, you know, a good one and then a bunch of not so great sequels, people kind of battle over how to rank these three movies.
And it's always a good one. It's always a good battle. That's the thing, is that because when you look at it's kind of like the Star Wars franchise. You can't really go, like, when you look at the original trilogy, to repeat myself or use this as an analogy again, you can't go wrong. Like, A New Hope is great, Empire Strikes Back is great, Jedi is great, but they all have different feelings and they all tell different stories. But yet, you're not going to be criticized if you say, oh, I like Jedi more than Empire. And you're not going to be criticized if you say you like Empire more than A New Hope. And that's the same thing with Toy Story 1, 2, and 3. All of them are solid motion pictures. All of them are fantastic stories with great animation, great voice acting, great production. And they're just amazing films. They're the pillars. They are the Avengers of the Pixar cinematic universe. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. And that I battled back and forth with putting Toy Story 3 on here because I think the only reason why it's there because it's on the top 5 because it's phenomenal, but it's number 4 just because I want to get some variety in there. And Toy Story 3 came out in 2010, and it's the top grossing Pixar film of all time.
Yes, I will let you talk about your feelings because, again, not to spoil my list, I may be talking about it later as well.
Gotcha. Well, I won't go too in depth with it, but this one surprised everyone. Everyone knew it was going to be a good film. Everyone, like, because the first two were amazing, but no one knew how amazing it was going to be. That's the thing, is that people were blown away. People were saying, this needs to be Best Picture at the Oscars. They're like, oh, Best Animated? No, screw you.
Best Picture.
Best Picture. And I was really surprised that it didn't win, or because, you know, Beauty and the Beast, you know, had that honor of being nominated for Best Picture. And with Toy Story 3, people were just blown away at the nostalgia that it brought on, and the way that they showed the passage of time, because, you know, like, when you...
It had been, because Toy Story 2 was either, I think it was 99, right?
Yeah, yes, it was 99.
So it had been 11 years at that point since we've seen a Toy Story movie.
That's right. And also, like, and 15 years from the original. And so 15 years goes by. Like, you saw a puppy in 1999 with Toy Story 2. Or like, actually, no, you saw – no, the puppy was at the very end of Toy Story 1 in 95. And then you see this 15-year-old – this old dog in Toy Story 3. And just the audience had this collective, oh, you know. And so they were experiencing passage time as much as we were. And so it made us connect on a level that we did not expect when we went to go see it. And also the furnace scene. Good Lord, the furnace scene.
Yeah, I've got to talk about that later.
Yeah, I mean, like, I won't go too much into it because I want you to be able to talk about it. But it's just it was no one was expecting it, and in that moment, the director and the filmmakers actually convinced us to think, whether we believed it or not. In that moment, we thought for a millisecond or a minute, this is going to be the end.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be it. This is how they die. They're going to kill these characters in this kid's franchise. They made us believe it, and I don't care who you are. If you say that you didn't think that even for a moment, you're lying. And I was laughing hysterically during that moment. I probably ruined the moment for a lot of people because in the theater I was this maniacal Joker laugh just because I was so nervous.
No, but let's be clear. It's not because you found the scene funny.
No, no. I was nervous. It wasn't because I thought it was funny. I was just like, oh my God. Oh my God, they're going to do this. Oh my gosh, I am feeling something. Like, I'm getting chills and I'm on the verge of tears because of these characters in a furnace.
Not to spoil my thoughts on the scene because I'm going to talk about it later, obviously, but that got emotions out of me that live action films don't get out of me.
Exactly. I think that's what people did not expect, is that this was more dramatic, this was funnier, this was more touching than many, many live action films that we've seen recently. So that's why it's number four. And even actually talking about it right now probably needs to be higher on my list. But that's my number four.
That's awesome. I'm not going to say too much about it because obviously I'm going to talk about it later.
Right.
So I guess we're going to move on to number three now. And my number three is one that's gone up in the years since it came out, not only because I think that I've seen it more, but because the things that it was lampooning, parodying, and doing have gone up in my estimation since I originally saw it. And so, and that being my number three, The Incredibles.
That's my number three as well.
I say it's gone up because back in 2005 when it was released, I really enjoyed the movie, but I was not the... Was it 2004? It was around that time because I think it was like at the end of 2004 that I saw it.
Yeah, it was November of 2004.
So that's why I think it was 2005. But so back at that time, I really enjoyed it. I liked it a lot. But I was not the superhero Marvel junkie that I am now, mm-hmm. where I can look at it now and appreciate aspects of it a lot more, being a fan of the genre. Back then, I had only really, really loved the first two X-Men and the first Spider-Man.
Okay.
And I don't remember what I thought of the second Spider-Man at the time. But, you know, that was my really only experience with superheroes at that point. So, you know, I didn't appreciate all the things that they were doing in that movie at the time. I just remember thinking it was fun. Now as an adult, that's the fun thing about Pixar films, too, is I think that you watch the ones that you saw as a kid, and you pick up even more on some of the things as an adult, which mm-hmm. speaks to the timelessness of them. But watching it now, it's a brilliant... whether you want to see it as a parody, whether you want to see it as another superhero film, this one just happens to be animated. I love pretty much all the aspects of this film. And what I love most, I'll talk about it here, but this applies to all Pixar films, is the casting choices that Pixar makes. Every mm-hmm. one of their casting mm-hmm. choices in these films that we're mentioning are spot on. And they're not actors that you would regularly think of. Who was thinking of Craig T. Nelson in 2004?
I know, right?
You know, or Holly Hunter, for that matter, who is an actress that I like, but, you know, wasn't on the tip of my tongue in 2004.
I love Holly Hunter.
So, you know, the fact that they show up and give the performances that they do, which are, you know, entirely voiceover, but that doesn't let them stop them. They were the right voices for the parts. And the movie's great. Again, what can you say after 11 years of it? But that easily makes it number three. And like I said, gone up since I became a Marvel junkie.
But. You know, it's really funny that you put it that way, because I had the same experience where I watched it and I was like, okay, that was a good movie, but then I moved on. But then as I watched it more, I started realizing more and more things about it. I started noticing more and more things and realizing that I never actually saw it as a superhero film. I saw it as a James Bond film. I saw it on much more of
a... But see, I think it could fit into all those genres, whether you want them to or... I mean, depending on what you're looking for.
Oh, no, absolutely. I was not arguing with you. I'm just talking about my personal experience, is that I saw it as much more of a 1960s super spy kind of film. And you can see at it, you can look at it from any level. You can, it's, most people see it as a superhero film, and I'm sure some people like me see it like a spy film. But I just love the aesthetic, the, you know, the technology and the clothing and the furniture. It was all very 1960s, late 50s kind of era, and I love that. And I love that kind of spy aesthetic. And watching it, you realize that it deals with some heavy themes. It deals with loss of a family, acceptance in high school. It deals with infidelity. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is stuff that you didn't think that you would see in a kid's movie, but it's okay for a kid's movie, but it's not like a dirty joke like in Shrek that kids just don't get. And it also deals with having an unfulfilling career. And also, like, there's this moment where the lead, you know, takes that super skinny girl. I can't remember her name, but like, she's the attaché to the bad guy, and
the Elizabeth Peña character.
Yeah, like he grabs her and says, like, you know, what's stopping me from snapping you like a twig right now? That was a really dark moment. And then he lets her go and he just starts crying, and you're just like, holy crap, this is intense. And it's just those moments, they get away with it because they build up so much goodwill and so much kid stuff and jokes and lighthearted stuff, but then they hit you hard with that intensity, and the kids either don't get it or they just get it on a low level, but it registers more with the adults. And I think that right there is kind of like why I like Pixar, is because it's truly a family film where it's not just a kid's film. You know, like in the 90s, we had the heyday of family films. But, you know, we don't really get them today. And this is something that adults can enjoy and kids can enjoy. And I like that. And so that's why it's number 3 on my list as well.
Yeah, everybody connected with this film. I remember, yes, it was November, because I remember my uncle was here for Thanksgiving and he took me to go see this film.
Nice. All right, well, what's your number 2?
Oh, yeah, it was both our number 3s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so number 2 was a film that back when the release material was coming out, I didn't think I was going to be that interested in it. It seemed like something that was going to skew younger than what I was. I was in 8th grade at the time, I think. Or getting ready to enter high school, and I thought, I looked at the stuff for this, and I thought, this looks more like a kid's film. I don't know if I'm going to like this. And I didn't end up seeing it in the theaters. It wasn't until DVD that I actually saw this film. But it's become one of my favorite Pixar films of all time, which is why it's number 2, and that would be Finding Nemo.
Oh, okay. I did not expect that answer. I thought you were going to say my number 2.
But I'm glad we're not, because it allows for some variety. Now I know that this is one that doesn't connect with everybody, but at the time, I mean, I was surprised how much I was pleased with this film. The humor was, you know, some of it was kiddified, but it wasn't too young that I couldn't get into it. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't sitting there as a 14-year-old humiliated that I was watching this kid's movie. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Again, the voice acting, top-notch, loved it. It actually really connected with me, you know, again, on the Pixar tugging at your heartstrings level. It was something that I sat down with my parents and to watch, and we were all getting into it. And even the in-jokes for me as a movie fan, I mean, the fact that the shark's name, the great white's name, is Bruce, I remember thinking it was so funny to me as a 14-year-old, because I knew the history of Jaws and the fact that they called the prop shark Bruce.
Right.
You know, they do that for film fans, and, you know, you gotta love Pixar for that. They put in references to films that adults love too. And I just watched it the other day in preparation for this show, and it still holds up for me. So that's why it's my number 2. And I'm, you know, a lot of, this goes for The Incredibles as well. They're both of these films have sequels in production at this point. And normally you'd be hesitant whenever a sequel to a popular film is being developed, even more so when it's being developed almost 10 plus years after the first one came out.
Yeah.
But it's so weird because it's Pixar, they've done long awaited sequels well. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt with both finding Dory and the Incredibles too.
And that's the thing, is that like we shouldn't look down on Pixar for sequels, because Cars was not a good movie, and then the sequel was not a good movie either. And so that's kind of like its own separate entity. I feel like Cars is its own thing. And then you have the Toy Story sequels, which we talked about are fantastic. And then you had Monsters University, which was just okay. You know, it wasn't a bad film, but it wasn't a great film. And so,
but that's what I thought about Monsters, Inc. too. So the fact that they were able to maintain that level of quality, I mean, says something.
Yeah, and so I think we should be optimistic for Finding Dory. I think we should. But yeah, Finding Nemo is one of those that it didn't really... I mean, I enjoy watching it every once in a while, but it's not one of my favorites. That's all I can really say about Finding Nemo. I think it has some great humor, some great in-jokes, but it's just not one of my favorites.
I think it hit me at the right time. I think at 14 was the right age for whatever they were going for on that movie.
Yeah.
So...
All right, well, I guess that leaves me to my number two, and my number two is what we just talked about, Monsters Incorporated. I love Monsters Incorporated. I think this is a near-perfect film. I really do. I think it's solid. I think the characters are spot on. The characterization of these people are fantastic. The like you said earlier, the voices, every single voice in this movie was casted perfectly. And... I can't imagine Sully with anybody other than John Goodman. You know, I absolutely love John Goodman and his voice acting, as well as Billy Crystal for Mike Wazowski. And just the story of Boo is so touching and so adorable. And she doesn't say a single word that you can understand except for Kitty. And you emotionally connect with this character. And it is such a great idea for the plot. It is such... a genius original idea that they have this scream factory where that's how they power their city, and how they get into the bedrooms is through the door system. It's fantastic. It's phenomenal. Again, this is so great. This is what dreams are made of. And it connected with me at the right time. This is one of those movies I did not see in the theater. Actually, I've only seen one Pixar film in the theater, and that's Toy Story 3. All the rest of them have been on video, and I resisted Monsters Incorporated for a long time because I used to sell TVs. Like, one of my first jobs was selling TVs, and we had Monsters, Inc. on there
constantly.
Stop. That was the movie that we had on loop.
See, that takes me back to an era where you go to the TV store and they all showing the same movie on 1,000 TVs so that you could get it demonstrated.
Oh my gosh, man. It was just like in 40-Year-Old Virgin, where they have the Michael McDonald concert playing over and over again, and the character goes up. He's like, I'm going to shoot myself in the face if I have to see this concert one more time. And that's pretty much the situation with me. And the reason why we put it up on there is because this was before high definition was really, really a thing. Like, you had high definition TVs, but you didn't have much source material for high definition.
No, and you know... This was back when we were transitioning, because Monsters, Inc. was 2001.
That's right.
And this is back when we were still transitioning from tube televisions to flat screens.
That's right, yes.
So, you know, we don't even have LCD televisions yet. We certainly didn't have LED televisions yet. We don't even have Blu-ray at this point.
Well, we had LCDs.
Did we have LCDs? I don't remember when
we had. We had LCDs, and we had plasmas.
Plasma.
And which that was an epic failure, because it was just too expensive. I mean, it was a great picture, but it was just too expensive, and they died out quicker.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're not maintainable.
And they're cost prohibitive to replace the plasma. And so we did have LCDs, but we also had DLPs, you know, we had projection TVs. And that was our main big seller in 2001, was projection TVs in 2002. And that's what I sold like crazy. And standard definition CGI movies looked amazing on reproduction TVs. And so that's why we played Finding Nemo and Monsters Incorporated on nonstop. I was just like, I can't take this anymore. And so when I got to the point where I had some distance between me and that job, I watched it again. I was just like, this is an adorable movie. And it's nice. It's popcorn. You can let it wash over you and just smile from ear to ear from beginning to end. And so that's why it's number two on my list.
I you know what, I have to give that movie another chance, because I saw it once when it was in theaters in 2001, and maybe I was just too young, maybe it didn't have the attention span, but I need to give it another chance as a 26-year-old.
You really do, because it is a solid film. It's number six on Pixar's top grossing list, and Finding Nemo was number two, I forgot to mention that, which is really surprising to me. I would not expect that. But the kids love Finding Nemo, even today's kids love Finding Nemo. That is their favorite Pixar film.
Whether or not you're a big fan of Finding Nemo, I know I'm taking this back to that movie, but if you have to subject yourself, because you usually watch these movies with your kids if mm-hmm. you have them, there are worse things that you could sit through.
Yes, there is. But there's only during the 15th rewatch of Finding Nemo, you might want to kill the fish yourself.
Well, sure, but that doesn't. but at the same point, you don't have to watch it 15 times with the kids. As long as you have it in the background somewhere as you're doing housework,
right,
to keep them off your back.
All right, well, that's my number two. I have a pretty good guess what your number one is going to be.
I think we both know what each of our respective number ones are going to be because we already spoiled them, but my number one is Toy Story 3.
Yes.
It's my favorite of the franchise. I decided a while back. I have to be honest, because like we were saying, it's hard to rank them because you're ranking three good films, but if you twisted my arm, my from favorite to favorite but lesser, because I can't even say least favorite because yep. that implies I don't like it. Mm-hmm. Toy Story 3, Toy Story, Toy Story 2. Toy Story 2 for me was the weakest of the trilogy, but that's not to say it was a bad film by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. But Toy Story 3 came out, the message that film came across came out at the right time for me because I was in college. I was 21 in 2010. And I saw this during the break between my junior and senior years of college. And I went to go see this with friends, and the whole theme of, growing up, approaching adulthood, moving on, do your childhood favorite things still have a place for you when mm-hmm. in your adult world? God, could it have not been a more perfect age to capture that than when I was 21 years old? Because that's the time that you're thinking about those things. Because now you can drink, you can do adult things. And, so do you still cherish your memories from childhood? Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how much that worked for me in that film. And it elicited every emotion that it was going for and then some. You talked about the furnace scene. I remember I was sitting in between my two friends who were going with me at the time. And when we got to that scene, instead of laughing hysterically, we kind of looked at each other and held hands. Like the characters did, because we could not. And the thing is that the movie had fulfilled its dramatic purpose enough to where you believed that could be the ending. They were going there. They were saying that this is a film where you let go of childhood. And I thought that, God, they're going to rip out everybody's heartstrings and they're actually going to do it. Mm-hmm. And realizing, of course, that they're not, because this is a kid's film. But the fact that even made you doubt that cliche
yes.
was going to happen, that's a real testament to the movie itself. And at the end when it's Andy playing with the toys for the first time in a long time with the new girl that he leaves the toys with.
Yeah.
Tell me, I'm unashamed to admit it, as a 21-year-old man, and then you're a couple years older than me, tell me that you didn't cry any man tears at that ending when he says goodbye partner and all that sort of stuff. We were all sobbing.
I definitely wasn't crying, and I'm not like I'll cry at a movie. I don't care. Like, I'm not trying to be a man here. I'm not trying to be a manly man or a macho man. I'll cry during a movie. But I didn't cry during that. But I definitely I got a little choked up. I definitely felt that one. Especially when that moment when the little girl sees Woody and Buzz and she goes to grab it and he kind of recoils real quick. Mm-hmm. And you realize I would have done the same thing.
Yeah. And then at the end, it's time to let go and the goodbye. Like, I'm not gonna resent Pixar for wanting to make a Toy Story 4, but I almost wish that they wouldn't, because that was such a perfect ending.
I struggle with that myself, because that is such a perfect ending, because it kind of brings the idea of a eternal continuance where it's she'll be raised with those toys, she'll enjoy those toys, and then she'll give them on. Those toys will live on forever, and those toys will be with a new owner continually, and you just imagine that that's going to happen. And with the Toy Story 4 coming out, you're just kind of like, well, where are they going to go from here? What stories can be told? And I'm sure it's going to be amazing. I'm sure it's going to be great. I have nothing but faith in Pixar when it comes to the Toy Story franchise, and they know how to handle the Toy Story franchise.
And I think they also know that that's their bread and butter. That was their foundation.
Exactly. And so that's why I have supreme faith in them. But at the same time, I'm with you where I'm kind of like, maybe we should just leave it where it's perfect. Because right now it is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
There's usually never a trilogy that where all three films are perfect, mm-hmm. or near perfect.
Yeah, and Toy Story is there. I'd say out of all the trilogies that exist, Toy Story has to be at the top.
So does that lead into your number one?
My number one, with no surprise, is the original Toy Story. And the reason why Toy Story is my number one on my list is just by the sheer fact that it is the original. And I'm not trying to be blasé, and I'm not trying to be pretentious by saying, oh, since it's the original, it's the best. I struggle with the same things that you struggle with the ranking of number 3 and 2 and 1 and everything like that. It's they're all fantastic films, and my ranking is probably 1, 3, 2, but 3 and 1 kind of flip-flop back and forth in my mind, kind of like Dark Knight and Batman Begins.
And again, I think that the reason I gave 3 the edge is because of the time of when I saw it and how old I was when I saw it.
Right, and... And that's the thing, is that I always feel guilty about putting 2 last, because I'm like, no, that's a great film. I love that film. I love rewatching that film. That has a lot of great moments. But somebody has to be number 3, and number 2 is that for me. So with number 1, I really love it because it's the introduction of all these people. We get to know these characters for the first time, and each character gets a significant amount of time focused on them. And it's mainly Woody, it's mainly Buzz, and those are my two favorite characters for obvious reasons. And in number 2 and 3, it kind of gets split up amongst all these new characters, because you get more characters in 2, and then you get even more in 3. And with 1, you get less characters and more focus. And it's just, it reminds me of childhood. It reminds me of how intense that feeling was when you actually got your own Woody toy or your own Buzz toy.
And not only that, but like, what kid didn't imagine this scenario with their toys, like what they come to life when you're not looking?
It's
who
really
didn't
funny.
Think that when they were a child.
That's the thing, is that it's such an original idea that is universal at the same time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like it's original because no one made a movie about it before, but it's universal because we've all thought about it before. And that is why it's number one. It's a fantastic film through and through. It's what started it all, and for that it'll always have a special place in my heart.
So that does it for our top 5 Pixar films. I'm actually, you know what, I'm because of such the good word of mouth and because of the nostalgia that I felt talking about these films, I am going to go see Inside Out this coming weekend, and I will report back, but I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully it captures some of the magic that we've come to love from Pixar.
I think so. Well, that's our episode. That's a wrap, and we thank you so much for listening. Please, if you like the show, please, please, please go to iTunes, find The Nerd Party, review us, give us a 5-star rating. If you do, we will mention you on the podcast.
And speaking of which, sorry we're getting to this a couple weeks late, but a new 5-star review came out from Intra86, who, if I remember usernames correctly, is... he goes by the name of Takarangalam on Twitter and on the Checkmate forums. He was a listener of the Delta Quadrant, and he was very excited when I told him that I was moving over to this show. And if this is you, Tak, then I thank you very much, and I'm glad you're enjoying the show, and thank you for the review.
And if it's not, we appreciate your review
the
more.
We appreciate any 5-star review, no matter who it comes from.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for doing that. And please, people, if you haven't done it, please take the time. It takes 15 seconds, and it means the world to us. And the more ratings we have, the more rankings we get, and the more listeners we get, and we'll spread the good word of geekdom and nerddom all across the world. So thank you so much. Go to our website, thenerdparty.com. If you want to talk to us, go to you can email us at contact@thenerdparty.com, or you can find us on Twitter. You can find me at The Insane Robin.
And you can find me at mhanson0207. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of The Nerd Party. And until next time, Tristan and I will be blasting off to infinity and beyond.
Coming up next week,
Cobra's new recruits will have their jaws shaking in their boots like the laser viper.
Rip 'em up!
And Metalhead, a one-man anti-tank weapon, and range vipers, so wild even I can't control them.
Nice bunch of losers, Reptile Breath. Now check out the new jaws. I
syllable! I open tanks like they was cans!
And Pathfinder!
Yo, yo!
Returning tomorrow for more bad news! Somebody shut that off!
Now collect Joe and Cobra command rings, free and special packages.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.